Okay, so, yeah, time to get started. Okay, so we were looking at a second example of how to calculate the vector gradient, the velocity gradient for a vector field, for a time-like vector field in a curve space-time, and bringing it down in terms of smaller pieces like expansion, shear, and rotation. So we're working in the Schwarzschild metric, and I introduced a vector field here. So those curves, so we're dealing here with a bunch of time-like curves. So it moves in the time direction. It moves in the theta direction with a constant coordinate velocity, omega. But it doesn't move, so the curves don't move in R. So R stays constant along each of those curves, and phi is constant along each one of those curves. And so in order to make sure that this velocity field is properly normalized, the gamma factor in front has to be equal to this. And as I said, it's very important here that the quantity inside the square root here be positive. And as I also said, that typically translates into a bound on omega given the radius of a given curve. Okay, so the idea is that we want to calculate the vector gradient to this and then break it down into all of the irreducible pieces. So the vector gradient is, the velocity gradient is something we can write down in terms of the acceleration vector, and then we have a trace piece involving the projection tensor, and then we have symmetric trace-free piece, and then we have the antisymmetric piece, and each of those pieces come with a very natural interpretation that's inherited from the Newtonian discussion. Okay, so well, typically what you would do first here is we have the vector field, so you would calculate, well, you could calculate the whole gradient in one sweep, and if you're using computer algebra, that's a fairly easy thing to do. It's just that you would get a whole bunch of components. And the idea is to try to break it down into things that can be interpreted. And the first one that we can look at here is the acceleration vector. The acceleration vector is the gradient of the velocity vector, but directed in the direction of the velocity vector. And that's something that can be computed, and I won't do the calculation by hand here. I'll just say that that vector comes with just one non-vanishing component, and that happens to be the R component of the acceleration vector. And I'll tell you what it is. And for all of the results that will follow for the next minute or two, I'll ask you, well, set yourself the challenge of doing this computation, hopefully using computer algebra. And that's going to be a very nice opportunity for you to learn how to do these computations if you haven't done so already. And then you can verify this and make sure that you understand how to do these computations, hopefully with the aid of a computer. So that's how I did that myself. So I put that on a computer and got those results. All right, so here's what the acceleration vector looks like. So there's a factor of r minus 2m, which is always going to be larger than 1 here, larger than 0, I should say. We're always going to be outside the black hole. And then there's a factor involving m minus omega squared cubed. And then there's a denominator that's given by r cubed. So that's the only non-zero component to the acceleration vector. And if we wanted this to be 0, well, we have two options. We can say that r is equal to 2m, but that would be wrong because that would be incompatible with the requirement that this prefactor here, this factor here inside the square root be larger than 0. So that wouldn't work. But the other option is to put that coefficient here to 0, and that gives us a condition on omega squared. So if we want the motion to be geodesic, we don't here, but if we wanted it, if we wanted it geodesic, then we would set omega squared equal to m divided by r cubed. And if we made this very specific assignment, we would get a vector field that is actually a geodesic vector field, and we would have a vanishing acceleration. If we still wanted to preserve this, we would have to insist that R be greater than 3M. So we wouldn't be able to have a time-like vector field that's also geodesic of that form unless R is greater than 3M. And some of you may recognize this over here as the statement of Kepler's law. So that's the statement that the angular velocity squared of a particle in orbit goes like the mass divided by the distance cubed. So that's something that's familiar from Newtonian orbital dynamics and turns out to be exactly the same if you do orbits in Schwarzschild. But anyway, so that's if you want the motion to be geodesic, but we're not going to make this requirement here. We want to consider a more general situation. Okay, so now that we have the velocity vector field and the acceleration vector field, we can put this over to the left-hand side and calculate the rest of it as we discussed before. So we can identify all the pieces, we can calculate theta, which is the divergence of the vector field, and then we can isolate all of the individual pieces like this. So theta, let me tell you what it is. So if you do this calculation, and that's just, you know, a very straightforward calculation of the divergence of the velocity vector field, if we calculate this, we're going to get gamma times omega times the cotan of the angle theta. And cotan, I'm sure you remember, that's cosine divided by sine. So that's something that will go to infinity on the North Pole and on the South Pole. So that's what we were talking about. We have a whole bunch of curves that all originate at the North Pole, all end up at the South Pole. So they all start from the same point and at the same point. And because of that, while we do have a singularity of the flow here, a singularity of the flow there, and sure enough, that's reflected in the calculation that we're doing here. So the expansion diverges in the North Pole because they're all coming out of a point and basically spreading out like this. And it diverges here because it's all reconverging to a point. And you know, that again is reflected by that singularity here. So typically when we're dealing with vector flows, we want to avoid those singular things. But here it's, you know, impossible to avoid because I set up a flow that has two singular points in it, you know, from the beginning. So it has to be paid, you know, that price has to be paid by the, you know, the occurrence of that kind of singularity. So nothing too surprising here, but typically when dealing with vector flows, we would like to avoid, you know, avoid those singularities. We would like to preserve the flow to be non-singular. Okay. So once we have theta, well, we can put all of this over to the left-hand side and we're left with the symmetric and antisymmetric pieces. So that's something that you can set up on a computer to calculate very easily. So I'll just give you all the components that are non-zero. So there's a whole bunch of them. So for the shear tensor, well, yeah, it gets a little bit tedious to write them all out, but we might as well. So minus a third omega cubed gamma squared, no, gamma cubed, sorry. And then R minus 2M, and the same cotan factor. That's going to be common to all of those things because it's not just the expansion that goes singular. It's all the components of the velocity gradient, and therefore all of the pieces will be you know, equally singular at the North and South Pole. So that's one non-zero component. We have sigma T theta. That's a third gamma squared. Omega squared gamma cubed R minus 2m cotan theta. And there's a few more. RR minus a third omega gamma R divided by R minus 2m cotan theta. And two more to go. Theta minus a third omega gamma cubed R minus 2m cotan theta, and finally theta phi, and here we get two thirds omega gamma r squared, I think, and then it's sine theta cosine theta. So that one is not singular, but it goes to zero at the two poles. All right, so those are the components of the shear tensor. It's a little bit hard to interpret directly. You can verify that this is a trace-free tensor, if you multiply this through with the projection operator, then you're going to get zero. But that's the thing that would be interpreted as the fact that if you follow one little piece of the fluid moving on one of those curves, the next one, if you examine that little piece of fluid, the fluid element would get shrink and expanding, as measured by this, but it will also deform so that, a cube would become something elongated or something, something like that along the lines we talked about in the Newtonian discussion. That's what this describes. And then there's two non-zero component to the rotation tensor that comes with this flow. And it's omega squared gamma cubed r minus 3m and omega r theta. And then you have other, the other components that come, with the antisymmetry property. So omega rt would be minus omega tr and so on and so forth. So basically here's, a fairly complicated velocity field that comes with non-zero pieces for all of the individual elements of the decomposition. So the acceleration vector is non-zero, the shear tensor is non-zero, the rotation tensor is non-zero, and the expansion scalar is also non-zero. So basically that's as complicated as it gets. But the point is that, each piece comes with, an interpretation that I think is pretty clear. And that's, the message here that, that's the reason why we decomposed the gradient in this way, to try to come up with simpler pieces that have a simpler interpretation as, an individual. All right, so the challenge for you is to, reproduce all of this. So as a, as a little piece of homework, I'm going to ask you to check this. And, the idea is to view this as a learning exercise in setting up a calculation like this on a computer using, a computer tensor package, if you have it, or setting up your own code in Mathematica or Maple to do these computations. Regardless, I think it's a good investment, and there's going to be plenty of opportunities for you to exercise that in future homework assignments. So it's an investment that I think is well worth it, and you can check that those results are actually correct. I'm sure I've inserted typos just to test your, your ability to detect them in the process. So. Right, so that's, that's this example here. So a slightly more complicated and more, maybe more interesting situation compared to what we had before in the cosmological example. So none of those things are particularly interesting really in itself, except for the fact that the expansion, all of them, but the expansion in particular happens to be singular, where the flow itself is singular, and, it's nicely reflected in that with a straightforward interpretation that if the, if all the word lines are coming out from one point, it's pretty clear that the expansion has to be infinite there. And if it's all reconverging toward a point like the South Pole, then the expansion has to be negatively infinite there. That's something that the interpretation in terms of the fractional change of volume comes in, I think, also pretty clearly. All right, so any questions about this? Yep.
I think I'm missing something. How can we define poles in
How can we define what?
We don't have any, it's very symmetric, right?
Oh, yeah.
How we define poles? I mean, I can rotate everything, and then I feel that that singularity should be important artifact, but it is not.
It's a good point. So it's not a coordinate artifact because, you're right. So we have full spherical symmetry. I could rotate the sphere and, put the poles wherever I want them to be. But the point is that, I defined a flow. And in the definition of the flow, I automatically selected two poles. So I picked an orientation for the coordinates, and I decided that, there's going to be a singularity here and an opposing one, and that's given to me by the flow. So yeah, I could rotate the coordinate systems, and then the poles are going to be displaced accordingly. But it's going to be the same situation.
Over there.
Yeah, so I could rotate this whole thing and then, you know, have the expansion at theta equals pi over 3 or something. It wouldn't, it would just be a much more complicated description of the same thing. So yeah, it's not a coordinate artifact, it's really something that is given to us by the division of the flow, and that selected a particular orientation for the coordinate system. Yep.
Another question. What is the specific GR effect here? I mean, in comparison, as if you set some particles to move on a spherical shell in 3D.
Right.
Should get the same thing, right? But what is specific about GR?
Nothing so much. So the physical interpretation of this, well, it's a bit limited because, okay, you know, how would you realize this flow in the first place using physics ingredients? The answer is I don't know, unless it's geodesic, in which case, well, I could use point masses to define the flow for me. If I do that, then I'm going to kill a lot of stuff, in particular the acceleration. Yeah, so there's nothing particularly physical about this or particularly meaningful about this. I think the idea was just to introduce an example where all of the tensors were non-vanishing. But I'm going to be driving toward an equation called Rachow-Dury's equation, so that's going to come a little bit later in the lecture, where the physical meaning of this is going to come out loud and clear, I hope, and tell us something very deep about gravity. So that's where we're going to be going in a few minutes. So yeah, so right now it's just illustrating how the decomposition works, but then we're gonna put a lot more meaning to this as we keep going in the discussion. Okay so let's leave this behind. So we're gonna move forward. So one thing that I want to do before I get to Rachow-Dury's equation is to talk about a situation where I would have a flow, so we would have those time-like word lines, and we would have a situation, and it's not always like this, but a situation where the flow lines are going to be orthogonal to a family of hypersurfaces. So that's the situation I want to describe next. So it's going to be a specialization of a flow that gives us this property of being hypersurface orthogonal. And the reason I'm doing this now is because that's going to be something I'm going to need to invoke when we talk about Rachow-Dury's equation, which will come next. So here's the situation. So suppose that we have a specialized flow. So a general flow will not satisfy this property in general. Specified flow such that the word lines that we're defining here through the velocity field are everywhere orthogonal to a family of space-like hypersurfaces. So the idea is pretty simple. So we have a bunch of word lines over here, and we have this interesting property given to us here, given the flow that has been defined, that those word lines, everywhere we look, are actually orthogonal to space-like hypersurfaces. So everywhere we look, we have a space-like hypersurface, and the word line happens to be orthogonal to it. And same thing here, same thing there. Everywhere we look, we have that the word lines are orthogonal to a family of hypersurfaces. So this is the flow with a tangent vector u. And this is a family of hypersurface. I'm going to label it. So this is going to be the family corresponding to some function phi equals 1, phi equals 2, phi equals 3, phi equals 4. And by phi, I just mean some function of the coordinates that happens to be constant on those space-like hypersurfaces. So a family of hypersurfaces described by an equation where we're going to put a restriction on the four space-time coordinates and make them constant on that surface. So, you know, in a very simple example, we would have in Minkowski spacetime the flow lines associated with T moving forward, the spatial coordinates being fixed, and then every spatial T equal constant surface would be orthogonal to those. So, and we can always define a hypersurface through a condition of this sort, which says, let's place a restriction on the four spacetime coordinates such that we get a constant. And then as we vary the constant, we get different members of that family, right? So what I'm saying here is that, so we're given hypersurfaces, there's gonna be a normal vector to those surfaces that's gonna be coinciding with the velocity vector, that's the condition of orthogonality. And when we have a situation like this, we have a specialized flow that happens to be, you know, very special, but very important from, you know, the point of view of Reich-Schrödinger's equation, where we're gonna go next. And what I want to prove is that under such occasions, when we have that, we automatically have that the rotation tensor vanishes. So that's what I want to prove. So it's a bit of a theorem. The theorem says that if we have hypersurface orthogonality, the rotation tensor vanishes, and we're gonna prove it in that direction. And there's also a proof that goes in the other direction. If the rotation tensor vanishes, that guarantees the existence of, you know, space-like hypersurfaces that are everywhere orthogonal to the flow, but I'm not gonna, you know, do the proof in that direction. I just want to establish, you know, a connection between that situation and that restriction on the velocity gradient. And, you know, again, we're gonna be using this for later purposes in just a few minutes. Okay, so that's the statement. If we have this situation of orthogonality, then we have a vector, a velocity gradient that's guaranteed to give us a vanishing antisymmetric piece. Okay, so how do we go about proving this? Well, what I'll be using here is the key notion that the velocity vector is going to be coincident with the normal, the unit normal vector to those hypersurfaces. So the key step in the proof is going to be to start from that statement and see what consequences that will have on the velocity gradient. So the key step here, the key input, is that the velocity vector u is actually the same thing as the unit normal vector to the hypersurfaces. And I'm gonna write down an expression for that normal vector, and then we're gonna make the vectors equal. And that will be basically the starting point of the whole proof, which is just, you know, a calculation that is pretty straightforward. Okay, so what do we know about normal vectors? Well, the normal vector is pointing in the direction where phi is changing. So we can distinguish the normal vector from all the tangent vectors that live on the hypersurfaces. And those vectors point in directions in which the scalar function phi is not changing, right? So if you're staying on the hypersurface and you have a vector pointing tangent to it, then by definition, that's the direction where the function phi is not changing, but the normal direction is the direction in which the function phi is changing. So the normal vector, I think obviously coming out of the statement that I just made, the normal vector, I can call it n to call it to use standard notation. The unit normal vector is guaranteed to be proportional to the gradient of the function. So the function changes that way, so the gradient points that way. The function doesn't change that way, so the gradient doesn't point that way. So we're saying that the normal vector being, you know, pointing in the direction of increasing phi is guaranteed to be proportional to the gradient of phi. And that's basically the definition of a normal vector. It's the gradient vector of that function that defines the hypersurface. So I'm sure you've done very similar things in elementary calculus. So it's going to be proportional. The only thing that I have to do here is to normalize it, because I insist that this unit normal should be, this normal vector should be a unit vector, the same way that the velocity vector is a unit vector. So I just need to insert a normalization factor and that takes care of everything. So I'm going to say that U alpha in this discussion, I'm going to insert a minus sign, because typically if the vector with the index up is pointing toward the future, the vector with the index down is going to have a minus sign like this. And I'm going to say there's going to be a normalization factor. I'm going to call e to the chi, just for, you know, fancy notation. And then I'm going to say it's going to be, apart from that proportionality factor, proportional to the gradient of the scalar function phi. And that's going to be my starting point. After that, I'm going to just calculate the gradient of that velocity field. But now I know that it's a special velocity field, because unlike any random, you know, generic velocity field, it's actually proportional to a gradient. Typical velocity fields would not be proportional to a gradient, so they would not share that property of being hypersurface orthogonal. So that's really the key thing, the fact that I'm making an equality between, or proportionality between, the flow vector and the gradient of some function. So I hope that's understood. After that, it's just straightforward computations. But I think it's important to understand the setup here, because everything follows from that. So any questions before we move this on?
So given a flow, can we always form the family of the hypersurface that this flow is also on?
No, so that's the point. So it's a very special type of flow for which that's true. And for that to be true, it's got to be true that the rotation tensor vanishes. That's what we're intending to prove. For any flow where this is not zero, then it's impossible to find a set of hypersurfaces that are going to be orthogonal to the flow. So that's the meaning of the theorem. Yep. Other questions? Okay, good. So let's see. So the rest of the proof is simply to, okay, take the gradient of this and witness after a while that there's no antisymmetric component to that gradient. So we're going to do that. And when I take the gradient of this, I'm going to have to take, well, two derivatives of my scalar function. So that's going to be part of the calculation. But I also have to take derivatives of chi. So before I get going with this, I'll just do a quick calculation on how to calculate the derivative of chi. And that's something that we'll need in in the developments here. So how do we figure out chi? Well, we just use the fact that the U vector has to be a unit vector. So we're imposing the fact that our U vector has to be normalized. So I'll write the normalization condition in this form right here. And then I'll plug in what we had for the velocity vector. So I'll have 2 powers of e to the chi, so it gives me e to the 2 chi. And then I have g alpha beta grad alpha phi grad beta phi. And that's an equation I can actually solve for chi, or for e to the 2 chi. So I'll just say that e to the minus 2 chi, solving for this, is going to be minus g alpha beta, g alpha beta grad alpha phi grad beta phi. So that's how I can determine that normalization factor. And if I wanted to, I actually calculate this, all I would have to do is to take the square root of this, and 1 over that would give me my e to the chi. But, we don't need to worry about all of this. Okay. But I'll use this equation to calculate the derivative of chi, because, as I said, that's something I'm going to need. So let's do that. So let's differentiate both sides of the equations. If I do the left-hand side, I'm going to get the same exponential factor back. And then I'm going to get 2, let's put a plus here. I'm going to get minus 2 grad chi. So I'll write it with index mu. So here I'm differentiating the left-hand side with respect to x mu, and that's what I'm getting. And then I'll do the same for the right-hand side. And for the right-hand side, I'm going to take the covariant derivative of this whole thing. The metric comes along for the ride. We don't need to worry about it. And then I'm going to have 2 terms. Covariant derivative of the first gradient here. So it's going to be del mu del alpha acting on phi, and then we're going to get the second gradient over here, and then we're going to get the first gradient coming along, and then two gradients on the second factor. So we're going to have that. And I'm going to clean this up a little bit. So I'm going to use the metric here to raise some of the indices. So with the minus sign, I'm going to factorize the minus sign. I'm going to use the metric to raise this index over here. So it's going to be gradient with alpha up, multiplying two derivatives acting on phi. I'll write it like this. And then I do the same thing here, but now I'll use the metric to raise, I'll raise this index over here. I could call it beta, but I'll call it alpha. So all I want to say here is that we're going to get twice the same thing. So here I used, I used a metric to raise the index. It should have been beta, but I renamed it alpha. And that beta over here has been renamed alpha. So I get this term over here, but it's exactly the same as what I had previously. So I can write this as minus 2 grad alpha phi, two derivatives acting on phi. And the last thing that I'll do is to replace the gradient of phi here by the velocity vector. So let's see, that kills a minus sign. It brings out a factor of minus chi. And then I have u alpha multiplying two derivatives of phi. All right, so now I'm going to equate this to the left-hand side we worked out before. Where was that? It was over here. So I'm going to solve for gradient of phi. So I have a minus 2 here. That's going to kill that 2 over here. I have a minus sign left over. I have those two exponentials here. I can kill some of that over here. And I think when everything is said, we're going to get that grad chi is going to be minus e to the chi u alpha, two derivatives acting on phi. And I think that should be correct. Yep, it's correct. So that's something that I'm going to need when we keep going with the calculation. So are all the steps okay here? All right, take that as a yes. One more thing that we're going to need in the calculation is the fact that when we're dealing with a scalar field, the order in which we take the derivatives doesn't matter. It would matter for vectors, and the commutator of two covariant derivatives would give us a term involving the Riemann tensor. But when it's acting on a scalar, those two derivatives actually commute. So one little property that we're going to be using in the calculation will be this symmetry property for covariant derivatives acting on a scalar field. So that's something that we will require in the following. Okay, so now we're prepared to take the gradient of our vector field. And you know, keep in mind that the goal here is to prove that the rotation tensor vanishes. So the goal is really to prove that the velocity gradient is actually going to be symmetric in the two indices. And that's something that will follow straight out of this calculation. Okay, so let's calculate the velocity gradient. So I'll write it like this. Grad beta u alpha. And what I need to do is to differentiate the right-hand side. So we're going to have a minus sign that's going to be common to all the terms. We're going to have a factor of e to the chi that's going to be common to all the terms. And when I take the derivative with respect to beta, the first thing that we'll do is to take the beta derivative of chi. And that will come with the alpha derivative of phi. And then we're going to have we're going to have two derivatives acting on phi. So that's what happens when we take the velocity gradient. That's what we get. And I'm going to work on this. I'm going to use the result we had for gradient of chi, and we're going to try to see if that can be put in some nice form. So we have an overall factor of minus e to the chi, and grad chi I'm going to rewrite as what it stands for. So what we have here is minus e to the chi. I'll write it as e mu two derivatives acting on phi. So that stands for all of this over here. And then that multiplies grad phi. And I think one thing that I did here was to change the order of indices on the second derivative here, because I said that I could, so I'm going to do it. All right, so all of this here is this over here with that attached. And then what's missing is that second derivative. Okay, so not too bad so far. I'm going to convert this and that into a u together with the minus sign. So that's going to clean up the result a little bit. So that's going to be u multiplying two derivatives acting on phi plus two derivatives acting on phi. So that's what we're dealing with. And I'm going to clean this up even a little bit more. And I'm going to be, so what I want to do is something like this. I'm going to keep the overall factor of minus e to the chi. And what I want to do is to factorize the two derivatives acting on phi. I'm going to factorize it like this. And for the first term, of course, I get my two velocity vectors. I get that. And over here, all I have to do is to, I'm going to switch the order again here. Doesn't matter. And what I have to do is to convert this alpha into a mu. And I'm going to do this with the Kronecker delta, or the metric. And you recognize this as the permutation, the projection operator. All right. So at this stage, we get, a fairly neat form for this. I'll write it over here. We get that the velocity gradient is something that we can express as this overall factor of minus e to the chi. And then we have the projection operator, index mu and alpha, acting on two derivatives of our scalar function phi. So that's a nice little result. And of course, we're not done yet, because what we have to decompose into, trace and, trace part, symmetric trace free part, and antisymmetric part is not the velocity gradient itself. But it's that plus or minus the acceleration vector part of it. So we're not quite done with this, but the hard part is over. So any questions about those steps that we took here? Yep.
Sorry, can you not write me just as the gradient of some function? Why do you not define some function f such that v is the gradient of that function?
Oh, could I dispense with the normalization factor? By redefining phi so that we still get the normalization property. That is something we can do if the flow is geodesic. If it's not geodesic, you don't have that that freedom.
I'm just thinking of this as so e to the chi and all the partial derivatives of phi. So can you not define some new function as just integrating e to the x, let's say.
Right. So can we rewrite this as minus
gradient, and then in there, hold on, and then you have the gradient of phi between gradients.
Right. So yeah. So if you tried, I will predict that it will fail unless we're dealing with the geodesic vector field.
Okay.
So that just wouldn't work. So in general, we can't dispense with that normalization factor. But if it were a geodesic vector field, then we could redefine a function phi so that it's always equal to a gradient. So that's something I was going to say at the end of this discussion. But yeah, it does require that extra condition that the vector field has to be a geodesic vector field. Yep, so that's a good point. Okay, so apart from that, the steps are straightforward. Yep.
Have any specific condition or feature on these hypersurfaces?
Like?
So in a way, if we want the rotation to be zero, I thought we can always have a surface so that it is, we might get a rotation, and also it is normal to each of these vectors at each point. Except if you have some condition on the definition of these hypersurfaces, maybe.
Yeah. So here we're making. So we're demanding something pretty large, in the sense that we want all the geodesics to be orthogonal to all of the surfaces everywhere in the where the flow is defined. So it's a very rigid set of conditions. Locally, we could probably have a surface, and maybe we could extend it at one moment of time, but then after that we wouldn't be able to extend it without introducing singularities or things like that at the next moment. So yeah, it's a very restricted set of situations that we're dealing with here. Okay, so let's see. So we have this expression for the gradient. And what I'm going to do is, I'm going to calculate the acceleration vector from that, and then I'll combine the two things in a way that we know. All right, so the acceleration vector is, I'll write it like this. It's going to be that particular component of the full velocity gradient. And we could just calculate this. It's going to be minus e to the chi. And then we have u beta p alpha mu. And we get two derivatives acting on the scalar function phi. So that's the acceleration vector. So it's just, it's just one particular component of this. But the thing that we want in our decomposition, decomposition that we introduced before, the thing that we started with was this combination. Let's make sure I don't make a mistake here. Right, so the thing that matters to us in that decomposition that we talked about is that combination of things. So that's the thing that we were decomposing before in terms of trace piece, symmetric trace free piece, and rotational piece. So it's the same equation I wrote before, except that I'm interchanging the alpha and beta indices. Of course, it doesn't make a difference here, doesn't make a difference here, but it makes a difference there. And what we want to show is that, when we work this out and we're about done doing this, we're going to find that the result is necessarily symmetric. So we're going to have those two pieces present, but that one is going to be absent. And that's going to be the end of the proof. So if we calculate that combination here, we just combine the two results. And what do we have? We have a common minus e to the chi. And then for the first term, we're going to get p alpha mu two derivatives acting on phi. And then for this over here, well, I'm going to combine it with what we had here for the acceleration. So I'm going to have plus u beta. And then I'm going to have u alpha written in this form, except that I'm going to have to rename this beta index because it's already been claimed here. So for that term over here, I'll call it u nu, say, p alpha mu gamma mu nu, acting on phi. So all we have to do now is to clean this up a little bit. And I'm going to do what I did before. I'm going to factorize those two derivatives, and I'm going to factorize this projection operator. And we're going to consolidate the rest, and that's going to give us another projection operator. So let's write it like this. I'm going to factorize the p alpha mu, which is common to both. And I'm going to factorize those two derivatives, and I'll write them like this in terms of mu nu indices. And what do I have? So for the first guy, I don't have mu nu, I have mu beta, right? So I can convert the indices using the Kronecker delta or using the metric, and I'm going to call that beta g beta nu. And that's going to convert this nu index into a beta index, as we have in the first term. And then what else do I have? I have u beta u nu coming inside the bracket. And all of that is multiplying what's, you know, common. And sure enough, we see another projection operator coming out. And now we're done. We have that this important combination here, the purely spatial part of the velocity gradient, is equal to what? Well, it's equal to, I forgot the overall minus sign here. It was supposed to be a plus. I have minus e chi. And then I have one projection operator, a second projection operator, acting on two derivatives of the scalar field. And that tells us that the right-hand side is symmetric under alpha and beta. And it tells us that the symmetric part, of course, is zero. And that tells us that omega alpha beta is zero. Right, because if I were to look at this and if I switch the alpha and beta indices, well, that would be the same thing here as switching the mu and nu indices. But if I switch the mu and nu indices here, I don't produce anything different. So that thing here is, I think you can convince yourself of that, that's actually symmetric in alpha beta. Because to say it again, if I were to, you know, think of switching those two indices over here, that would be exactly the same as switching the mu and nu indices here, which would be the same thing as switching those two mu and nu indices. But we've already talked about this, you know, those second derivatives are actually symmetric. They commute because they're acting on a scalar field. So that is symmetric in alpha and beta. And that means that in the decomposition, we're going to have non-vanishing symmetric pieces. Those two are going to be non-zero. But the antisymmetric part is going to be zero. So that's the theorem. The theorem says that if you start with a flow that has this very restrictive property of being everywhere orthogonal to a set of hypersurfaces, then the rotation tensor vanishes for that. And it works the other way around too, although I'm not going to prove this. If you find a flow like this that has a vanishing rotation tensor, then you're guaranteed to find a set of hypersurfaces that are going to be orthogonal to that flow everywhere. And I've proved this without relying on the flow to be geodesic. So the flow is general, so it could be an accelerated flow if we wanted to. But then to go back to Behrend's point, if we did have a geodesic flow, then we could refine this and, in fact, show that in that case, for a geodesic flow, the velocity field is, in fact, not just proportional to a gradient, it's actually equal to a gradient. So that's something I talk about in the book. I go through a proof of this in the book. I also have, you know, a discussion of that in the posted notes, but I don't think I want to spend the time to do that in class. I think it's a smaller technical point that probably we won't really need to invoke at any point. All right, so that's the idea, that if we have that kind of restricted flow that's hypersurface orthogonal, then we have a vanishing rotation tensor. When we're talking about a time-like flow like this, built on time-like word lines, that's a pretty big restriction. I mean, most flows don't satisfy that. When we take the discussion to null curves and null geodesics in particular, we're going to see that that's actually a fairly natural thing to expect from a null flow. And we're going to see that the restriction is far less severe in that case, and much more natural when we're dealing with null congruences. And that turns out to mean something for what we're going to be talking about eventually. But I'm just, advertising this for the future. Yep.
So we discussed that hypersurface orthogonality is a property of the flow, but at what point do we gain the interpretation that it's a property of space-time?
So it's really a property of a space-time and a property of the flow together, right? So you have to specify the space-time first, then you specify the flow, and then you ask yourself whether or not it's hypersurface orthogonal. If you want to turn that into a property of a space-time all by itself, you would have to justify the flow from first principles of some kind. For example, if you have a killing vector, is the flow proportion, is the flow that comes with that killing vector hypersurface orthogonal? The answer may be yes, the answer may be no. So the point is that, if you want to turn this into a property of a space-time versus flow, the flow would have to come naturally as a specification of the space-time. And I think that's something you could easily do if you have killing vectors. But other than that, you would have to have some kind of preferred vector field in the space-time to give you the flow in the first place. So I would say that,
I have a space-time that is hypersurface orthogonal, but also...
Well, I don't know what that means. I don't know what's a space-time being hypersurface orthogonal means. You need a flow to specify orthogonal to what?
Is it not good enough just to say that any hypersurface orthogonal flow exists in an hypersurface orthogonal space-time? Because
Again, I don't know what hypersurface orthogonal space-time means.
I guess that would be the definition, is that a hypersurface orthogonal flow exists.
In any space-time?
In a quote-unquote hypersurface orthogonal space-time. Because there are space-times where such a flow can't exist, and those are ones that are not hypersurface orthogonal, right?
Yeah, I don't...
If we study the geodesic case,
right,
then we can somehow say that, if this kind of flow exists, that space-time is after separate.
Am I wrong in saying that such a flow like this cannot exist in the Kerr space-time, for example? It is not a hypersurface orthogonal space-time.
Well, because you're thinking of the killing vector, the time-like killing vector is providing the flow, and it's true that for that killing vector, the flow is not hypersurface orthogonal. So I really insist that you're thinking of a flow either explicitly or implicitly. But I don't think there's any notion of hypersurface orthogonality for a space-time all by itself.
Surely you can come up with a hypersurface orthogonal congruence in Kerr space-time.
Yeah, I mean, if you define a whole stack of hypersurfaces and take the normal direction, that's going to be a hypersurface orthogonal flow. So if you start with the hypersurfaces, and you can always foliate any space-time with a stack of hypersurfaces, the normal flow will be hypersurface orthogonal by definition. So it's not a restriction on the space-time.
So what do you call the insistence that the Kerr space-time cannot be written with an off-diagonal without an off-diagonal term?
Well, it's because you're using coordinates that are adapted to the killing symmetries.
But and doesn't matter. In any coordinate system, you cannot find a coordinate system in the curve to represent the Kerr space-time that is all diagonal.
True. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
What do you call that?
I don't think there's any deep. I mean, most space-times would not be able to be written in diagonal with a diagonal metric. So that's not a very distinguishing property.
What I think I'm wrong is that the structural space time is hypersurface orthogonal and
so stop saying those words. They don't mean a thing.
But you can write it as a diagonal metric because you can find orthogonal coordinates. But in curved space time, you cannot do that.
Right. So I think implicit in all of that is that you want to define the flows using the killing vector as a defining flow for you. So I mean, otherwise, you know, you can foliate the curved space time, you know, with hypersurfaces. You can define a flow that's orthogonal to those surfaces, but the metric would still be highly non-diagonal if you were to use those coordinates, I would think. Anyway, so yeah. So I think there's no direct, you know, correspondence between those statements. But yeah, okay, that was a fun discussion. Yep.
So here also, I think I'm misinterpreting something. So when we say that U is always normal, then I was thinking, okay, that could be enough to think that, okay, that's why the rotation shouldn't exist, because if it wants, these guys want to get into, rotate, then somehow they should have some non-normal component. Then in that case, I expect expansion also to be zero.
No, that doesn't. So think of cosmology, right? Think of the cosmological example that we had before. So that was clearly a flow that was hypersurface orthogonal, and we had a non-zero expansion. Yeah, so the interpretation sometimes is tricky, and I think with the thing about shear notation is, you know, there's always a tendency, and I know I've had it in the past, of associating these things with a global rotation of a hypersurface or a global, you know, so especially for rotation, there's the tendency for me to identify this with an overall rotation that I might, you know, describe by a coordinate rotation. And it's not that, it's really the relative rotation of one word line with respect to a neighboring word line. So it's that local rotation that is captured by the omega tensor. And that's a little bit harder to visualize unless you do what we did in the Newtonian case, to go to the, you know, the reference frame of that one fluid element and see what happens to the neighboring ones. So that's where it comes together. But yeah, it's tricky. Yep.
Yes, the image is just familiar. Does this have anything to do with split derivatives?
Not directly, I don't think. I don't think that the Lie derivative would come into that in a sort of direct way. So I don't see that. You had a question?
Do you have a question?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. If we add cosmological constant to our metric for the expanding universe, still shear will be zero.
What would be zero? Sorry?
Shear, sigma alpha, beta.
Well, the shear doesn't have anything direct to do with the cosmological constant because, in the case of any expanding cosmology described by the standard Robertson-Walker metrics, the shear is guaranteed to be zero because the space-time, the spatial sections are spatially homogeneous. So that's why, so for any cosmological flow like this, it's always going to be true that that the shear tensor is zero, that the rotation tensor is zero. But it's certainly true that the way that the expansion is being affected by the cosmological, that the expansion of the universe would be affected by a cosmological constant. And that's something that, if I have time today, we'll actually look into. That's part of a, you know, coming example.
So about Kerr metric and Gödel universe, omega is zero, or whether omega can be non-zero?
I think for a Gödel universe, it's certainly going to be non-zero. But you would have to give me the flow. So you would want to, you know, tell me what flow to consider in the Gödel spacetime. And, you know, you'll get different results depending on that choice. Kerr, same thing. Kerr, same thing. Yeah. So you had a question?
Yeah. So is omega tensor related to the curl of the flow?
Yeah, so in the Newtonian analogy, we saw that the rotation tensor was directly related to the curl of the vector field. So we can still think of this connection in this case, although it's more, you know, it's more indirect in that case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's no notion of curl in four dimensions.
Yes.
Okay, good. I like it when you interact. Okay, so so we've got another 20 minutes or so. Okay, so I think I have time to cover Ray Chowdhury's equation. So here we have that statement of hypersurface orthogonality and that one-to-one diagnostic that if the rotation tensor, then we're guaranteed for the flow to have this property of being orthogonal to a set of hypersurfaces. And the reason why I was talking about this is that, well, that's something I'm going to invoke. Probably I won't have time today, but that's something that's going to come out again in the following lecture, something that we'll need to invoke at some point. So you'll know what this means. And what I want to do now is to introduce what I think is probably the most insightful equation of all of gravitational physics. And I know I'm making a very bold claim. I'm saying that that equation is far more insightful than even the Einstein field equations, than any equation you might have encountered, because it's going to tell us in the end how to describe the attractive nature of gravity, something which is, can be a little bit hard to put in precise terms. But that gives us a means to do that. And it's also, it's an equation that gives us a way of understanding very gross properties of a space-time without having to do any calculations. And I'll say what I mean by that. So that equation is known as Ray Chowdhury's equation. Ray Chowdhury was an Indian relativist. Who formulated that in the context of cosmology, but then it was generalized to, you know, any context like this. And what is that? Well, it's basically an evolution equation for the expansion scalar, or better said, the rate of expansion. And here's the idea. You know, what we're going to want to say at some point is, okay, so suppose that I have a congruence of time-like word lines, and I see them to be, you know, spreading out, therefore expanding away from one another, something that would be measured by a positive theta coefficient. Well, if gravity is attractive, we would expect that this relative acceleration of all the word lines, we would expect that to decrease in time. So that maybe the tendency of those word lines would not to spread out, but to actually converge together. In other words, if they're expanding, I would expect them to be expanding far, you know, less rapidly in the future than they were in the past. I would expect that the rate of change of the expansion, the acceleration, the relative acceleration, let me put it like this, would be negative. So it can still be expanding, but it would be expanding less rapidly in the future. Therefore, the acceleration associated with that is something we would expect to be negative. And that would capture the notion that, well, all this stuff is being pulled together by gravity. So that's the idea, and that's the thing that the Ray Chowdhury equation will allow us to, you know, talk about very precisely. So it's an evolution equation for theta. And what I want to do, therefore, is to derive an equation that will look like, if we're following the flow, what is this thing? So theta would be something analogous to the relative velocity of the flow, and that would be analogous to the relative acceleration of the flow. And we want to see what the right-hand side is, and we want to see if we can, you know, make a statement to the effect that the right-hand side, under, you know, most circumstances that we can identify, will be negative. So that's the idea. So it would tell us that gravity tends to focus geodesics, and it tends to not defocus. So here I'm saying geodesics. I'll come into that a little bit later. Okay, so that's the idea. And I want to derive an equation like this. And well, the strategy is going to be pretty simple, right? So theta is equal to the divergence of the velocity field. So that's something we worked out before. And therefore, I could calculate the rate of change of this along the flow. But just to prepare the way, it's going to be simpler to actually work out the full evolution of the full velocity gradient. So what I want to do here is to work out this thing. And we're going to see what that is. And then when we're done, we're going to take the trace of that. That's going to give us the rate of change of the expansion parameter directly. So that's the idea. So what do I mean by this? Well, I mean the derivative along the flow of the velocity gradient. So that's the thing that I want to work out. And we're going to work it out by just expanding the right-hand side and see what that gives us. OK, so basically, we're going to have one factor of mu and two derivatives acting on the u vector. And I'm going to do what we often do here. We're going to switch the order of derivatives. And we're going to bring out the Riemann tensor, and we're going to see what's left over. So this I'm going to rewrite as u mu. And then I'm going to consider the commutator of those two derivatives. And then what I'm going to do is to make up for the difference by re-expressing the result like that. So, so making up for the difference like this. OK, so let's work on that. So the first term, obviously, will bring us a Riemann tensor term. So I have to look it up because I will mess up the indices. So that thing here is going to be Riemann tensor index nu. Beta mu alpha acting on u nu. So if you remember how the commutator of two derivatives here works on a cotensor, that's what we get here. We get a Riemann tensor that looks like this. And this guy over here, well, I'm going to rewrite it in a sort of creative way. So what I'm going to do first is, let's see, what do I want to do here? I'm going to throw in oh, I made a mistake. That's supposed to be the repeated index. Right, because I was multiplying by u mu throughout. So this is the same u mu. Yeah, so what I want to do is to throw in this u mu inside the first derivative. And that's going to identify for us the acceleration vector. And then I'm going to make up for that difference by taking out this velocity gradient multiplying this velocity gradient. Right, so all of this amounts to this, and this amounts to that. And over here, we have the acceleration vector. OK, so let's put all of these things together. So on the left-hand side, I have the rate of change of the full velocity gradient. And on the right-hand side, what do I have? So I'm going to write it as it's given to me. So r nu beta mu alpha. And then I have one factor and then one factor of u, another one factor of u. So it's written like this. And then I have the gradient of the acceleration vector. And then I have two powers, or two occurrences, of the velocity gradient. Like that. No, sorry. Like that. Okay, so that's an evolution equation for the full velocity gradient. And then the calculations, I think, are not too bad. But now I'm going to take the trace and calculate the rate of change of the expansion scalar directly now. So I'm done with the full thing. I don't need it. What I'm going to do is to take a trace. So I'm going to contract alpha and beta. So that's going to give me the rate of change of the expansion scalar if we do this contraction. And over here, let me rewrite this. Well, I'll write it, let's see, as a plus. So before I do that, let me just rewrite the Riemann tensor term, because it's not presented in a way that's going to be the easiest to work out. So I'm going to lower and raise the indices like this. And then what I'm going to do is to swap those two sets of indices. So I'm going to use one of those properties of the Riemann tensor that allows me to swap the first two indices for the last two indices, and that doesn't change anything. And then what I'm going to do on top of this is to swap those two indices individually. So if I swap this like that, that would give me a minus sign, but I'm going to do it over here again. So the final expression that I wanted is this one right here. So just using symmetries of the Riemann tensor to rewrite that term, and that doesn't change anything. But now it allows me to take the contraction with alpha and beta, and that's going to define the Ricci tensor for us. So if I now take that contraction, so the gradient contracted with the u velocity, that gives us the divergence of the vector field. That's the expansion scalar. The contraction of the Riemann tensor will give us the Ricci tensor. And finally, we have, I'm going to write this term first, we have minus alpha mu alpha. So you can write it like this. So contracting alpha and beta. So I should put this alpha up there. And then finally, we have the contraction here. So we get the divergence of the acceleration field. OK, so it's a bit of a, you know, cumbersome thing. But in the end, we have a nice looking equation. I'm just going to rewrite it. We have that the rate of change of the divergence scalar can be expressed as minus the Ricci scalar contracted with a four velocity, involves the velocity gradient in that combination, squared in that combination, and then involves the divergence of the acceleration vector. With a plus. Thank you. All right, so that is almost where I want it to be. Yep. So the other thing that I'm going to do here is to reintroduce the decomposition of the velocity gradient into those expressions here, and we're going to square that, and we're going to have our Ricciardi equation fully decomposed in terms of all of those small pieces. So I think I have time in the next 2 minutes to do that. All right, so let's remember that, okay, I'm going to write it as, yeah, this gradient over here, well, that was a term involving U and A. And then we had all the other pieces. So that was the full decomposition of the velocity gradient we started with this morning. And that's what I'm going to be substituting into that that squared thing over there. And then I have the other one with the indices switched and the indices upstairs. So I'll write them with the indices upstairs. And here I'm going to have U beta A alpha. And over here, well, I should switch the indices, but my projection operator is symmetric, so it doesn't matter if I do, so I won't. Same thing for the shear tensor. It should be switched, but it's symmetric, so it doesn't matter. But for the rotation tensor, I have to switch them. And if I don't want to switch them, I have to make sure to use the antisymmetry property and plug in a minus sign. So that's what I did here. So now we're going to square this. And it looks like, you know, it's a big operation to do, but it's actually very nice because most cross products actually vanish. So let's work it out. So we have to multiply each term by each term. So if I multiply this by that, I see that I get A multiplying U, and that's zero, and I have U multiplying A, and that's still zero. So that first product here vanishes. And after that, well, I have this multiplying that, but this is orthogonal to U, so that product vanishes. And then, well, similar story here. This is orthogonal to U, so that product vanishes. This is orthogonal to U, and that product vanishes. So far, we get nothing. So we're done with this. Now we have that. Well, this multiplies this, gets zero all over again. Same story here, same story there, but we're not quite there yet. So we're done with this. This times that, well, we get 1/3 times a third, that's 1/9. We get theta squared, and we get p squared. P squared is 3. So the first non-zero term here is 1/3 theta squared. So we're done with this. This times that, well, that's 0, because the shear tensor is, you know, trace-free in the sense that its contraction with the projection operator is 0. And that product is 0 as well, because this is symmetric, this is antisymmetric. So that product always vanishes. All right, well, that's pretty painless. So now we're down to this. This multiplying that is 0. This multiplying that is 0. And now we get the shear term squared. This multiplying that is 0, symmetric, antisymmetric. And now we're down to here. So omega multiplying this is 0, omega multiplying this is 0, omega multiplying this is 0. So now we get minus the squared omega term. So one key advantage of working out a decomposition like this is that when you multiply these things, you know, most products actually vanish, and it's only the squared things that survive. All right. Well, now we're in good shape. Now we have our final version of the equation. So the rate of change of the expansion parameter along the flow, let me group those square terms first. So we're going to have minus 1/3 theta squared minus sigma squared plus omega squared. And then, let's see, I'm going to write the Ricci term. And then we're going to have the acceleration term, gradient, divergence of the acceleration term. So that's the statement of Ray-Chowdhury's equation. And, you know, formulated like this, it's formulated pretty, you know, in pretty general terms. And it's, you know, formulated in a way that is, you know, too general for turning that into something useful. because remember what the goal was. The goal was to use this equation as a way of saying something about the attractive nature of gravity. And that's the statement that you can have Judy's world lines flying apart, but they're going to be flying apart less rapidly in the future because of the attractive nature of gravity. So that's saying the same thing as having a universe that expands, but will be expanding less rapidly in the future. Everybody would think that this is a good property for the universe to have, and it's only about 15 years ago that the universe changed on us and gave us an acceleration instead of deceleration. We're going to talk about why as a consequence of all of this. But basically, if we wanted to say something about the attractive nature of gravity, we would allow theta to be positive. It's possible to fly, to fly apart, but we would like that acceleration to be negative. And we have some promise for this, right? This comes with a negative sign, and it's a squared quantity, so that wants to be negative. That's the square of a tensor that is actually a spatial tensor, so it's guaranteed to be positive. It comes with a minus sign, so we're all in good shape. But here, here we have an obstacle. That comes with a plus sign. It's also a squared quantity that's positive, so that spoils things for us. So that's why we're going to be thinking of hypersurface orthogonal curves, because that's going to allow us to kill that and kill the potentially positive contribution to that. This we're going to have to think about. It comes with a negative sign, but can we guarantee that this is necessarily positive? And the answer is maybe, but not really. So depending on this, we're going to have to, say something about the fact that gravity should be attractive always, but sometimes it's actually repulsive. It's going to be thanks to this guy over here. And finally, while that also comes with a positive sign, the sign of this is not clear, so we're going to kill that by, restricting our flow to be a geodesic flow. So when we're all done, we're going to make stipulations on the kind of flow we want to look into. We're going to kill the terms that we know we couldn't control, even if we tried. And then we're going to be left over with that last term here that we can, perhaps say something about depending on the nature of matter. And we can, hopefully turn that into a statement about the attractive nature of gravity, except that, in order to say something like this, we're going to have to place some pretty heavy restrictions on the type of matter fields that are present in the spacetime. And that's going to sort of, dampen our enthusiasm a little bit. But anyway, it's going to be a first good start. And, I'll advertise for what happens next. When we reformulate Ricciardi's equation for null geodesics instead of time-like geodesics, we're going to see that we can make a much cleaner statement with, conditions on the Ricci tensor or on the stress tensor of matter that is less restrictive. So even if our hope for a statement about the attractive nature of gravity is not going to be so easily met with time-like geodesics, with null geodesics, it's going to follow much more cleanly. And null geodesics, I would argue, are even more fundamental in the space-time. And therefore, it's sort of natural to expect that we can make deeper statements and more definitive statements about the attractive nature of gravity in that context. So that's where we're going to go. So next week, I'm going to pursue this a little bit more, and then we're going to move into the null geodesic regime where things are interesting. So I'll say it like that. Okay, enough for today. Any questions before we quit? Yep.
I thought when we first step up before anyone who studied this expansion or converging or diverging properties, I thought we should study the derivative of the tangent vector along.
Right, along the deviation vector. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But what you are looking
at
u and r.
So I could have reformulated all of this in terms of the behavior of the separation vector, and that's how I set it up in the book. But it turns out that while we can get to the same thing without introducing the deviation vector, because theta is giving us this relative behavior without having to make this explicit in terms of the deviation vector. But it's all the same thing. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, good. So I'll see you next week.